Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
In this episode of the Best of the Pigskin Dispatch Football History Headlines, we discuss how Charlie Brown, the comic strip character, came about, and also how the term Crimson Tide became associated with the University of Alabama football program. These and many more legendary stories coming up in a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and this November 16th Football History Headlines has got some great stories for you, so let's not delay any longer, and let's get right at it as we go to November 16th, 1907, Birmingham, Alabama. The 12th Iron Bowl is played as Auburn and Alabama finish at a stalemate of a 6-6 tie. According to RollTide.com, the name Crimson Tide is allegedly to have first been used by the Birmingham Age Herald sports editor Hugh Roberts in describing this very game. The game allegedly was played on a sloppy, muddy quagmire of a field, and Auburn was a big favorite in the game. But evidently, the thin red line, as Alabama was often referred to in that day, played a great game in the reddish-colored mud and held Auburn to that 6-6 tie, thus gaining the name the Crimson Tide. Zip Newman, the former sports editor of the Birmingham News, probably popularized the name more than any other writer. This was the last football contest between the schools until 1948, when a series resumed once again. November 16th, 1924, at Dunn Field in Cleveland, Ohio, the Cleveland/Canton Bulldogs winning streak ends. The Canton Bulldogs were a dynasty in the early NFL. According to the American football database Fandom.com, the Bulldogs were unbeaten in 25 games from 1921 through 1923, suffering only being tied three times in that span. In fact, they were the champions of the newly named National Football League in 1922 and the top dogs in the league in 1923. The NewsHerald.com has a story that fills in some of the story on the team's transition into 1924 to become the Cleveland Bulldogs. Apparently, the owner of the rival Cleveland Indians pro football team, a Cleveland-area jeweler named Sam Deutsch, entered into an agreement on August 4, 1924 to buy the Canton Bulldogs franchise, players, equipment, and yes, the whole kit and caboodle. The sale was a win for both teams as Canton's owners had great teams with good attendance at the games but were struggling to turn a profit, while Cleveland had cash flow but lacked the firepower to put fannies in the stands. So before the 1924 season started, Deutsch named the coach as Guy Chamberlain, the player coach and stud player from the University of Nebraska, who through his strategy and coaching led the Bulldogs to their 22 and 23 NFL championships in Canton. Deutsch demanded that some of the core players of his former Indians team still be in the lineup, especially quarterback Hogue Workman, an All-American from nearby Ohio State. The Cleveland Bulldogs were a powerhouse, as the combined rosters of the Indians and Bulldogs were what, in essence, was an all-star team of the two clubs. He promoted them as the Cleveland Bulldogs, and the team continued the Canton Bulldogs' unbeaten streak by dispatching the Chicago Bears in their opener that season 16-14. Then tying the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets the next week, then rattling off a string of victories over the likes of the Akron Pros twice, the Rochester Jeffersons, and the Dayton Triangles. It was on November 16th, though, riding a 31-game unbeaten streak dating back to the Canton, but the Bulldogs were finally defeated on the gridiron. It was a second meeting with the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets that ended the streak, as the Jackets knocked off the Dogs 12-7 in Cleveland. November 16th, 1952. According to the OnThisDate.com website, it was the first time in Peanuts comic strip that Lucy held a football for Charlie Brown. However, the SchultzMuseum.org website claims that the first time Charles Schulz used the football idea in his comic strip was in 1951, although Violet is the one holding the football for Charlie Brown in that instance, as she pulls it away more out of fear than just for being mean like Lucy did. The theme was then shown nearly every autumn through the run of the comic strip. There are 37 strips where Lucy herself actually pulled the ball away from Charlie Brown, 11 animated specials, and 4 Charlie Brown and Snoopy shows episodes. There was one time that she didn't pull the ball away, and Chuck, in some unintentional way, got his revenge as he kicked her finger. That was finally your day, Charlie Brown. November 16th, 1957, Cleveland Browns rookie running back Jim Brown was something special even in his initial season in the league. Incredibly, Brown set an NFL season rushing record of 1,163 yards after only 8 games of 1 year removed from college. Per the website sportsha.com, all in all, in his 9 seasons in the NFL, he led all rushers for 8 of them. That's why there's no doubt that Jim Brown is one of the greatest running backs in NFL history. November 16, 1957, in Norman, Oklahoma, Oklahoma football's NCAA win streak ends at 47 after losing to Notre Dame 7-0. The Oklahoma Sooners were the defending college football champions. Oklahoma had a 47-game win streak going into the home game against Notre Dame, who was, by the way, the last to defeat them. What occurred was a defensive slugfest, with the game coming down to a late fourth quarter drive by the Irish. The BleacherReport.com's David Funk explains the sequence of events in his 2008 article. The Golden Domers had a series of successful plays that put them at the Sooners' 8-yard line as the clock was approaching 5 minutes to play in the game. The Irish ran a ball on 3 consecutive plays to advance the ball to the Sooners' 3-yard line. Because of a poor kicking angle, Notre Dame decided not to attempt the field goal. The Sooners sat back expecting a run up the middle on the fourth down play, and they put 8 men in the box to stop it. Irish quarterback Bob Williams then faked a handoff up the middle to running back Nick Pietrasante, and then pitched it to Dick Lynch around the right end, and he ran it across a goal line stripe untouched to give the Irish a lead. Notre Dame's extra point was good, and they had a 7-0 lead with 3:50 left to play. A couple of series later, with less than 2 minutes on the clock, Oklahoma moved the ball to the Irish 24-yard line as they were looking to tie the score. But on the next play, Bob Williams, who doubles as a defensive back for the Irish, picked off the pass by Dale Sherrod to seal the win, and the Sooners' 47-game win streak was over. Now let's take a break from our football history headlines for just a moment. Focus in on that subscribe button on the Embed Player. Click it so you get all the podcasts released right to you as soon as we release them. Also, you can reach us at pigskindispatch@gmail.com. Right now, I've got a message from one of my friends at the Sports History Network.
Hi, this is John Gidley. Join me each Friday for a trip into the football attic, where I'll delve into forgotten but noteworthy stories of the National Football League. You're bound to learn something new or have your memory jogged each week. That's every Friday, only on the Sports History Network and wherever podcasts are available.
November 16th, 1997, Commonwealth Stadium in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The 85th edition of the Grey Cup took place as the Toronto Argonauts were pitted against the Saskatchewan Roughriders. The Boatmen were the better team that day as they won the coveted Grey Cup by the score of 47-23. Argos quarterback Doug Flutie captured the MVP honors after throwing for 350 yards. While on live TV, after being named the Grey Cup MVP, Flutie handed the keys to the Dodge Dakota pickup truck over to Paul Mazzotti, who was named as the game's most valuable Canadian. When Flutie's generosity was acknowledged by the announcer, Flutie remarked, "I have one from last year." Yes, Doug Flutie was the MVP of the 1996 84th Grey Cup game as well. And oh yes, we have more CFL action, as on November 16th, 2003, at Taylor Field in Regina, Saskatchewan, the 91st edition of the CFL's Grey Cup was played as the Edmonton Eskimos were pitted against the Montreal Alouettes. Both teams sported an identical 13-5 records coming into the CFL championship game, and it made for a tremendous buildup of the game. OurSportsCentral.com lays out the game's highlights. Led by the passing of quarterback Ricky Ray, who had 22 completions on 32 attempts for 300 yards and 2 touchdowns, and the receiving prowess of Jason Tucker, who grabbed 7 of those passes for 132 yards and those 2 scores. These efforts aided Green and Gold to capture the 12th Grey Cup in franchise history with a final score of 34-22 over Montreal. Edmonton's Jason Tucker was the game's MVP, and the most valuable Canadian was Alouette wide receiver Ben Cahoon, who sported two touchdown receptions of his own on six catches for 148 yards. Now, how about we celebrate some birthdays of Hall of Famers? As we go to November 16th, 1965, in Medina, Pennsylvania, Gordy Lockbaum, a two-way running back and defensive back from Holy Cross, is born. Lockbaum seldom left the field during his college career, as footballfoundation.org explains. He played halfback and wide receiver on offense, cornerback on defense, and excelled as a kick returner on special teams. Gordy was pretty darn special on both sides of the ball. Heck, one week during the 1987 season, he was its team's both defensive and offensive player of the week. His offensive prowess was highlighted by the time he scored six touchdowns against Dartmouth in 1986, as well as a 1987 Villanova game where he caught 15 passes for 196 yards. Lockbaum was second in 1987's Maxwell Award voting, finished fifth in the Heisman voting in 86, and third in 87, and won a variety of lesser-known collegiate gridiron awards. The National Football Foundation voted Gordy Lockbaum into their College Football Hall of Fame in the year 2001. We hope you got something out of those football history headlines for the November 16th show, and we hope that you will be tuned back in tomorrow, because we have a lot more coming at you with your football history headlines. So make sure you subscribe to this podcast and all of our podcasts on the Sports History Network by hitting the subscribe button on any one of them. And on tomorrow's show, we'll cover November 17th's football history headlines, and we have the results from three Iron Bowl games, the first NFL team to travel by plane, and the first time the Crimson Tide game is broadcast on television. So tune in tomorrow. Don't miss it. That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.